We've covered various poskim, various meshivim across about 8 centuries so far. We haven't actually covered the 20th century yet. So tonight we're going to do a tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, one of the great poskim of the latter half of the 20th century. He's widely known for his medical halacha. Much of the, he has some 20 volumes of tshuvas, I guess several thousand probably tshuvas, which are, many of them are medical related. He was very friendly with Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, who actually is his correspondent here, who we often consulted. They often discussed medical halacha questions. He wrote extensively on things like abortion, on genetic testing, and things like that. He also, however, he was a tremendous baki, a tremendous talmid chacham. Many of his tshuvas show an extremely broad range of erudition. This tshuva tonight is on intellectual property, specifically on the Torah analog, the halakhic analog to the fair use doctrine, the notion under American law that you're allowed to copy certain limited amounts of copyrighted material for fair use, a doctrine we'll have to discuss more later. The truth is that the entire topic is difficult because, as we've discussed elsewhere, the whole idea of intellectual property in halakha, what the theoretical foundation is, what the parameters are for what protections the halakha award an intellectual property holder or creator, are very unclear. So every posek who discusses how the halakhic laws of intellectual property apply to a specific case, in principle, really should have to first demonstrate what model, what theoretical concept of intellectual property he's dealing with to begin with, and then discuss how his model should be applied to the case in hand. There's no real consensus. This tshuva itself is no real exception. We're going to see the various arguments advanced by Rav Waldenberg to justify his conclusion, but again, they tend to stand and fall on based on what his theoretical model is. As we'll see, much of what he says is debatable or is not necessarily entirely compelling. So just by way of background, so intellectual property wasn't a huge deal in halacha until the 19th and the 20th century, largely because there was no really convenient way of copying, of wholesale copying. With even printing was a fairly laborious and difficult task. Still, as things got cheaper and more efficient, there began to be tshuvas about copying. It's worth noting that virtually all the early literature until the 20th century, probably, almost all of it deals with what we would consider commercial infringement. Basically, one publisher had published a work, and someone else produced a competing edition and was cutting into the sales of the first one, and the first one wanted either an injunction or wanted royalties, some percentage of the sales. The notion of copying for personal use, which is something we all face all the time in the internet age, or even the photocopying age, you want to copy a magazine article, copy a song from a CD, can download something from the internet. That was something that doesn't really get any attention until mid or late 20th century. This tshuva in the Tzitz Eliezer is one of the classic discussions, classic attempts to kind of advance, clarify how the halachic notions of intellectual property apply to personal use copying. A number of other tshuvas, we'll discuss some of them and how their treatment of intellectual property parallels or differs from his. First, we'll discuss his tshuva. So just a little more background, a little more introduction. So intellectual property, as the notion of property per se, is quite controversial whether halacha recognizes such a notion at all. There's nothing in the Talmud or in the early poskim that clearly articulates any notion that you can own abstract property like intellectual property. In U.S. law, of course, it's justified by the Constitution. There's a specific provision in the Constitution that says that in order to further the useful arts and sciences, Congress shall have the right to pass intellectual property laws. That they weren't called intellectual property back then. They are basically copyright, patents, and trademark, as we have it today. My wife works in the USPTO, the Patent and Trademark Office. So under American law, we have three types of intellectual property protection, more or less. The two ones that are relevant to us are, the two big ones are patents and copyrights. Copyrights are to literary works or even computer code. If you actually copy someone else's work, whether it's a painting or a photograph even, something that the means by which something is expressed, that particular formulation, if you copy it from somebody else, that violates his copyright. under some regimes, you used to have to actually register a copyright in order to get copyright protection. Today, under the Berne Convention and the standardizations of copyright under intellectual property law, you don't have to register anything. By the mere virtue, people often don't realize this, by the mere virtue of being a creator of something, you may have never even heard of copyright, you're entitled to automatic copyright. Still recommended you register it, you get better damages, and you can prove it more easily, whatever. But the point is, copyright itself, under modern law, inheres automatically to the creator of something. It gives him specific rights. People can't copy it. Patents are patents, real patents as opposed to design patents. Patents protect inventions, basically, methods and machines, inventions, devices that accomplish some useful goal. It doesn't matter if you copy or not. If I patent something and you're machaving to it, you come up with it independently, even earlier in some cases or later, but if I have a patent, you can't do it. That's why in the computer world, for example, the open source movement, you can reverse engineer and create software that does exactly the same thing as a word processor or a web server or anything else. That's fine. As long as you're not copying someone else's code, there's no copyright involved. But if the methods the software uses are patented, even if you come up with a version that works completely independently, you still violate patents, and that's a huge headache. Even if we're willing to do all the work on our own to duplicate it, you still violate patents. Now, halacha doesn't use words like, the early halacha, we'll see that Rav Waldenberg does use the word copyright in the second line, kuf pei vav yud resh yud yud tes. Certainly the early halachic literature does not use words like copyright or patent. They refer to just either using classic halachic principles or intuitive notions of what's fair and what's right. But most of the halachic literature deals with what modern law would call copyright. Someone wrote a sefer, which was the early version of the question usually. Later posts can discuss music, software programs, paintings and stuff like that. Most of that falls under what we would call copyright. There is actually some halachic discussion of what we would call patents. One of the very famous early tshuvas on the topic from the 19th century was by Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson in the Shalom Eishiv. He was actually asked about what we would call a copyright question. There was the work of Pesachei Tshuva, the halachic work Pesachei Tshuva. There was a dispute about whether somebody could publish it against the objection of the heirs of the author. And he tries to argue that halacha does have a notion of intellectual property, and he kind of combines what we would call patents and copyright into one big idea, and says that, he quotes an anecdote, there was a certain Jew who had developed a certain type of mechanical, presumably, calculating machine. Asa ha-cheshbon b'machine, he says. He made a machine that could make cheshbon. And the Polish government, he says, paid him royalties, and continues to pay him royalties for his invention. So you see, secular law recognizes what we would call patents. So if the law recognizes it, halacha has to recognize it too. Again, we would call that a patent, which at least under modern law, you have to file for it, and it's a special thing. He doesn't get into all those mundane details. The way he expresses it is that there's an intuitive notion which general society recognizes that a creator, an inventor, someone who innovates something should be entitled to benefit from his ideas. The law recognizes it, halacha should too. Very powerful doctrine if you take it to its, if you think about it, that you can simply borrow any concept that the law recognizes and say halacha ought to have such a concept too. Obviously, the question is, how do you filter the good from the bad? The law has lots of things with which you might not always agree with. How do you know what's good law, what's bad law? But Nathanson seems to be applying his kind of moral intuition, a sense of it makes sense, it's fair. If the law has it, halacha should have it too. Many posts can push back on that, and they say, no, that's actually not how we develop halacha. This parallels debates in modern jurisprudence, whether looking to foreign law to create rights and to clarify American law is a good idea. And some of the more liberals, universalists, think that's a great idea. We should have a good, as I think it was Jefferson who wrote, a good respect for the opinions of mankind. Conservatives often say, not interested, Europe can do what it wants, we should make our own laws. So halacha in general, we don't usually look to foreign law to tell us what the halacha should be. Sometimes we do, like everything else. Here, Rav Nathanson was willing to just look at secular law, say it makes sense, it's an intuitive notion that a creator should have the right to his own work, whether it's creator of an invention, like an adding machine, whether it's the author of a work of Torah, like the Pesachei Tshuva. Either way, he says, he just creates kind of by fiat, the Torah has a notion of intellectual property. Many other posts can push back. And so on. And there are a number of other theories under, besides a straightforward property right, a number of other halachic theories by which Postkin have attempted to construct some kind of thing that resembles intellectual property jurisprudence. So, for example, some poskim talked about the notion of unfair competition. The halacha has the notion of yarid lo mischavero, that certain methods of competition are unfair. So one of the earliest tshuvas that at least resembles an intellectual property tshuva, even though it isn't really, that everyone talks about, goes back to the 16th century. There was a major case involved the printing of the Rambam. Now, the Rambam, of course, nobody held a copyright to it. It was hundreds of years earlier. Nobody claimed copyright to the Rambam. What happened was there were two competing editions of the Rambam that were put out simultaneously. In those days, in Italy, the Jews couldn't print at all. They weren't allowed by the law. It was the Christians who printed, and when the Christians wanted to print Svarim to make money, they would hire Jews as their editors, proofreaders, and cut them in on a share of the profits or pay them a salary, and then they would make money off the printing. So there were two Italian printers who were bitter rivals. One of them engaged the services of the Maram Padua, one of the great acronym of the time, a great Italian acronym, to help him produce a Rambam. He edited it, he put in notes, and so on, and he produced an edition of the Rambam, the Mishneh Torah. Another Italian, who was a bitter rival of the first, decided he was not going to stand for this, to be scooped in the production of the Rambam by his rival. So he produced his own edition, he found other Jews to edit his Rambam. He actually dumped it on the market below cost. He just wanted to kneecap his rival. He wanted to show him that you're not going to get away with competing with me. The Maram Padua, who stood to lose a lot of money by this cut-rate Rambam, appealed to the Ramah, the author of the Haggadah Ramah, Shulchan Aruch, appealed to him for an injunction that obviously he couldn't tell the Christians what to do. We didn't have control over them. He wanted an injunction, though, on the consumers. The consumers of the Rambams would basically all be Jewish. He wanted an injunction that no Jewish consumer should buy the second Rambam, which was infringing on the rights of the first printer, and more relevant to us, the Maram Padua, to sell his Rambam. The Rama did grant the injunction on a number of grounds, a number of far-reaching grounds, many of which are not relevant to us, four major theories. One of them has to do with unfair competition. The Rama argues that competing in such a way, particularly if you're dumping, what we would call dumping, selling below cost to just to hurt a rival, is illegitimate competition, and therefore... So the Rambam doesn't create any notion of intellectual property. Again, the Rambam was nobody's property. If he actually ripped off the Maram Padua's glosses, his notes, that might have been intellectual property. That wasn't the primary issue. But the Rambam, this Mahalakha of the Rambam, he justifies his injunction largely on the basis of unfair competition. And this is something we find in many of the later tshuvas. They try to construct some model by which the infringer of what we would call infringer of a copyright is somehow guilty of unfair competition. Again, remembering that the early tshuvas were all dealing with commercial infringement, not personal infringement. An infringer was someone who ran off his own printing run and tried to sell them and cut into the profits of the first business. Poskim tried to argue that was unfair. You were infringing on the first producer. And even though, again, halacha generally has a very laissez-faire notion of competition, halacha generally allows different competitors, different vendors to freely compete. But here, you're ripping off someone else's work, and you're dumping, and you're selling below cost, and you're behaving maliciously and irresponsibly. Here, Poskim were a little bit quicker to issue an injunction that you shouldn't compete in this manner. So we'll turn now to the actual tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer. Again, he was asked this question by Rabbi Dr. Avraham Sofer Abraham. Rabbi Abraham himself, Dr. Abraham, Professor Abraham, is a Talmud Chacham in his own right, as well as a leading expert on Jewish medical ethics. He's the author of a number of Svarim on medical ethics, the Lev Avraham, Mishmas Avraham. English versions are out there also. As I said, he was a frequent correspondent of Rav Waldenberg. This particular shaila, as we'll see, touches on medical questions. It is not primarily a medical question. The question was as follows. So reading the first paragraph, Avakesh Lishol Mikvot Taraso, Rabbi Dr. Abraham asks the Tzitz Eliezer, I have a question for you. Benogel Tzilum Mamarim. Tzilum is copying, photocopying, presumably. What Mamarim? Mamarim are articles. What kind of articles? Either Refuyim or Taranim. Either medical articles or Torah articles. I want to copy these articles either misefer, either from books, or ksaves. Ksaves is what we would call a periodical, which could be anything from a popular magazine to a journal to a Torah periodical that comes out now and then. I want to do this, he says, l'shimush atzmi, for personal. All these qualifications are important. I want to do this for personal use. Kisha b'shara sefer. My problem is that in the introduction, in the flyleaf of the book, Oksaves, or the journal, Mofia Azhara, there appears a warning, as you will typically find in pretty much any sefer or book that you look at today. For example, this Arts Girl Siddur, all rights reserved, all everything, text, punctuation, format, translation. No part of this book may be reproduced in any form, photocopy or otherwise. You know, they often write photomechanical, electronic, optical, whatever. Even for personal use. The injunction explicitly says that they are denying you the right to copy even for personal use without permission from the copyright holder, etc., etc.
Now, that's a legal asset. That's a civil non-Jewish asara, presumably. Is there an Indian sheer... He's saying personal use. There's also some called fair use doctrine,
yes,
which I don't...
That's my title here. Intellectual property and fair use.
Oh, okay.
We're going to get to that, yes.
Okay.
So this is legal. This is legal language, as you said. They do add, and this is a touch on fair use, they do add, except by a reviewer who wishes to quote brief passages in connection with the review written for inclusion in magazines or newspapers. So they give you one exception for reviewers.
Are they trying to define the universe of fair use?
That's a good question. I did not speak to Archibald's lawyers. I cannot answer that question, but that's what we're going to discuss. What is fair use from a Western legal notion? What is fair use? Does halakha recognize any notion of fair use? To what extent is it analogous to the legal notion of fair use? And right. So that's a question. Rabbi Dr. Abraham says that there is this azhara, there is this warning, she'ein lahatik shum chelik me'atochen, you can't copy anything of the contents, any part of the contents, without permission of the author, lo rishus ha-mechaber, ha-motzi la'ar. This is an important point. He says, without permission either of the author or the publisher. People often don't realize that the way publishing works commonly is that the author may often assign his rights, transfer his rights, sell his rights to the publisher. This happens in music, where the artist typically, when they sign with a label, the label then is the rights holder. This happens in the written word. My sister writes for one of the from magazines. She writes serials or short stories. And she, at one point, she wanted to republish some of her work in a book, and she didn't know that much about copyright, and she very quickly learned that she didn't hold the copyright to her own work, because when she had initially signed her contract, they owned the right to her work. So from then on, I think she renegotiated the terms that they actually offered her. They said, we'll pay you a lower rate if you keep your copyright, we'll pay you a higher rate if you give us the copyright. But yeah, very often, if you're writing for somebody else, if you're selling your work to somebody else, they'll own the copyright. Or if you do work in the course of your employment, like a scientist who works for a company or even works for a university very often, anything you produce may very well belong to the university or the company.
We had that. We published something. Johns Hopkins published something for us. One of the co-authors left out the, when he handed it, could just work with the people who make it look nice and whatever the graphics, just left out that line of copyright assigning. And I think he did it on purpose. But they came right back. Whoever reviewed it for me, and they always reviewed it, came back and said, no, that belongs to
us. Put that in?
They put it in.
Okay, good. Or not good, but anyway, so that's the question. He's not getting into that distinction, but he's saying it says he can't copy anything at all. And again, Rabbi Abraham adds, and he madgish, I want to emphasize that Hamadubar, that the question I'm asking you is ach v'rach l'shem limud v'shimush atmi. It is for my personal education and personal use. Lo l'shem miskar, this is not for commercial purposes. B'chol zos, ha'am yesh kan isur shel gezel o'isur achar. Am I doing anything wrong by copying an article, journal, magazine, book, chapter for personal use? Oh, is it mutter? And that was his question. And we'll skip the rest of the question. That was the question as posed to Rav Waldenberg. So, when he asked the question, he says that there's a warning not to copy anything. In the course of the tshuva, Rav Waldenberg is going to add that he's discussing even a case where it says explicitly, as the Archgirl does, even for personal use. Not just is there a warning not to copy any portion, there is a warning which explicitly says, do not copy even for personal use. Now, let's turn to the law for a moment. So the law, as you mentioned before, the law has a notion of fair use. The law had, this is a major exception to copyright restrictions. The law allows copying for fair use. What is fair use? So the courts have been trying to figure this out for decades. Fair use initially began not as a statutory rule. It began as the courts basically carved it out as they thought it made sense and it was fair that copyright shouldn't be absolutely restrictive. And because it wasn't kind of planned initially by a legislature, it came out kind of apparently haphazardly over the years. The courts added and revised and refined. Eventually, Congress did adopt statutes to codify what fair law is, but the statutes were meant to largely reflect, I think, what the courts had developed. So perhaps as a result, the fair use doctrine is something of a hodgepodge of considerations. Basically, fair use considers four factors. And it's not specified exactly how these factors are supposed to be weighed, but there are four factors, none of which are dispositive in and of themselves. There are four factors which determine whether a given type of use is considered fair and therefore permitted without permission from the copyright holder or not. One of them is percentage of the work being copied, whether it's the whole work, a fraction of the work, how much vis-a-vis the whole. One is the nature of the purpose for which the work is being used, whether it's commercial, personal, review, parody, and so on. Again, none of these factors are dispositive in and of itself. You can have commercial use, which is fair, and you can have personal use, which is not fair. But on the whole, something which is personal will be more likely to be considered fair use than otherwise. There are considerations of the originality of the work. A directory of businesses would have less protection than the great American novel written by somebody. I forget the other factors, the other details. But the law doesn't always give you, except for actual case law, doesn't always tell you exactly what is allowed. Reviewing, as you mentioned before, is a classic example which courts have held as fair use. Quoting small amounts of a work, at least small amounts of a work in a review is fine. Every now and then you get some overzealous company which, you know, some snarky blog post destroys a movie, and in doing so they post a 45-second clip of the movie and make fun of it, and the copyright holders get really upset. They say, take it down, it's our IP, and the answer pretty much always is tough. If it's a few seconds of a two-hour movie, 30 seconds of a two-hour movie, and we're doing it for the purpose of review, not so people can pirate the movie, then that is mutter. Again, classic fair use used to be, let's say, a couple of sentences from a book. Today it can be a video or anything else. So a small thing for review is typically going to be okay. Parodies. The courts have held that parodies are considered fair use. But the point of parody, it can't just be that you're changing the words to make a knockoff and sell someone else's music under your own term. Parody has to be, you have to be commenting on the original. You have to be kind of making fun of its seriousness or its clichédness or pointing out another point of view. You know, every now and then they argue about something, that people will just take a pop song and write different words to it and say it's a parody. That's not quite that simple. You have to actually be commenting on the original in some meaning. And again, obviously, people can argue what's a parody and what's not. Parody is notoriously hard to define. So these things often end up in the courts. But fair use is a big thing. You frequently find overzealous corporate lawyers issuing takedown notices for everything. They'll insist it's RIP, and the defense often is it's fair use, and courts then have to decide what is fair use or not. So the question is, as we've been saying, does halakha have a notion of fair use or not? And that's essentially the question Rabbi Dr. Abraham was asking Rav Waldenberg. If I want to copy these articles for personal use, is there some kind of fair use exception in halakha to allow it or not? Again, he's kind of taking for granted halakha does have, in general, some kind of respect for intellectual property, for copyrights in general. And he wants to know, does halakha make an exception for some type of fair use? Rav Waldenberg answers emphatically, yes, it does. He feels quite strongly that halakha would allow what Rabbi Abraham was contemplating, the copying of articles for personal use. He writes a rather long tshuva explaining why. His tshuva comprises mainly two or three lines of reasoning, two or three arguments for why it should be mutter. The first one was anticipated by Rabbi Dr. Abraham himself in the question, and this involves the notion of custom, of yeyush, of expectations of the publisher. If you read Rav Waldenberg's treatment, so the first paragraph he states his tentative conclusion. He says, "L'dati nira shetzilum amarim yisefer uksavei sashimush atmi," copying articles from books or periodicals, personally, is mutter, even though he says, even though it says you can't do that, since it's for personal use, yibayisem asvari, yibayisem akra. He's going to give a few arguments, some based on just logic and reason, some based on actual formal halachas and psukim, to explain why he thinks it's mutter. First, he gives a svara, and he writes in the second paragraph, Kishmar Gisha Batsim Kvodo, as you, Rabbi Abraham, you yourself have suggested, since it is Minhaga Shel Olam, it is the common custom of people to copy for personal use, Hamotzi Lar Yodeh Mizeh, and the publisher knows that his work will be copied for personal use, Im Kein Memela Misyayish, he gives up, he resigns himself, the publisher resigns itself that his work will be copied, Umavater Mirosh, he gives up going forward, initially going in, Al Hataka Matzilim Kazeh. Zosomeris, he says, in other words, Amdina Ladaite, we presume that the mindset of the publisher is Shalomoti Laar, Shagam Shel, he says, Shagam Shez Bate Lahashir Bastama, even though he explicitly says, do not copy, Lo Lahatik Shum Chelik Masefer, O Ksaves, Lo Rishuso. Believe Lahaya Lesser, he doesn't really mean it. Amdina Le Ladaite, we assume his real intention was, Believe Lahaya Lazar Gamlok Yonzeh. He knows he won't be able to enforce it, he says, and also because primarily his primary goal is that we don't want it to infringe on his business. The last line of the second paragraph, Matar is Adonis, for a criminal intent, Shalasagas Gvul, of unfairly cutting into his business, of competing with him, Ohalam Hashem Mechabro, or plagiarism, taking credit for someone else's work. Zelo Shayech, that does not apply when the goal is personal use. Now, this, I think, is a highly debatable argument for a number of reasons. He's arguing that 2 points, really, which he mixes together. First of all, the publisher knows he can't control it. Second, he doesn't really mean it. His primary goal is not just to make people's lives miserable. His primary goal is to sell books and to have a viable business. The problem is, personal use, many other posts can point this out, personal use, even if I have no intention of sharing with anybody, not even my best friend, everyone who copies a personal use is one potential customer who's not buying the product. If reducing, you know, taking it to the extreme, if everyone made copies of personal use, one copy gets sold, then everyone copies of personal use, and no other copies get sold. You only sell one copy. Obviously, that wipes out the publisher's business. So arguing that this is not commercial infringement is, to some extent, besides the point. Yes, I'm not profiting off your work. If all the potential customer, or every potential customer has this argument of personal use, and if they all do that, then he can't sell any copies. So the Rapp post,
Kim. You know, I know, just the modern logistics of journal publication, forget the internet, change, whatever. But at least in scientific journals, I don't know about cover journals, there is almost no such thing as individual commercial commerce. No individual buys physics journals.
Libraries and corporations.
They're only institutions. First of all, they're incredibly expensive.
Yes.
And they're only bought by institutions, libraries, and whatnot. And even when you publish, now normally they say you have to pay to publish. In fact, you do have to pay, except nobody pays. Only institutions will pay to have their people publish. And those individuals, there are some who are not affiliated with an institution to pay, there the publisher will bring the way. But so there is no individual commerce. I don't know how that.
So I hear that point. That's certainly an argument that carries weight in the model of journal publication. Even there, I would suggest there are still probably at least marginal cases where it will affect business. If I'm a small university and I have maybe 10 researchers who might need a couple of articles from some journal a year, so if they can't get it any other way, my university may have to find room in the budget for that journal. If they all can make personal copies from their friends at Harvard, the university won't buy the journal and they'll rely on it. So yeah, you're right. I mean, certainly the journal model lends itself more to his argument, but even there we can debate it. Certainly the other examples he gives from Torah or from regular books, yeah, so you're right. It would depend very much on individual context, but certainly to apply this in a sweeping general way to copy any article because it's personal use, yeah, that carries more weight perhaps in the journal model of publication, much less weight in other contexts. And again, right, he was speaking, he did mention specifically journals, so he might have been thinking of journals when he wrote this, but certainly if we try to extend it broadly, the argument is a little problematic. The other aspect of his argument, the publisher knows this, the publisher expects this. This is, you know, the lawyers have an expression, you know, this proves too much. If you really take this at face value, you pretty much wipe out copyright in general. Even commercial piracy is rampant today. You know, there are commercial pirates who make knockoff CDs and knockoff software and sell them and all over the place. So if you really want to argue that once any level of piracy reaches a certain threshold of ubiquity, at that point the publisher knows and waives it, ain't ever self. I mean, you know, lots of types of theft are common. You know, different types of embezzlement and tax fraud and lots of types of crimes are common, and businesses know that they have to build that into their business model. They know that they have to live in the real world. That doesn't mean it's allowed. If the, you know, the business might even take into account fraud, waste, and abuse, they might even know that their employees pilfer a few percent of the take per year, and they take that into account and they set their prices accordingly. That doesn't mean that that kind of pilfering is mutter, because the business knows it's going to happen. If something is wrong, it's wrong.
Is his argument definitely? Is he talking about a case where you don't own the book or you didn't buy the book? Let's say I buy the
Sims. He's going to discuss that.
No,
you're right. He's going to discuss the fact that you may have bought the book too. Yes, we're going to get to that too. You're right. That may be an important distinction. And right, I've been kind of talking about modern piracy where you just download off the internet. He's probably talking more about cases where Reuven has a physical copy of the journal, and Shimon says, "You know, Reuven, you have that journal. Like, can you give me a copy of it?"
Reuven has it, and Reuven wants to make his own copy. Because he wants to take it on the bus.
So that's, in that case, where you yourself own the book and you just want to make a copy for convenience, today they use words like format shifting or time shifting, where you have right to the IP, you have a right to use it, you just want to do it. You know, the original version was time shifting with the VCRs. You have the right to watch this programming, you're just not available at 5 o'clock and you want to watch it at 7 o'clock. So time shifting. Then they talked about format shifting, where you want to put it on your phone and the movie comes in one format and it doesn't play on your phone. Your phone doesn't even have a slot for VCRs, so you want to put it into some digital format for the phone that they call format shifting. So that, I don't know of that much halacha that deals with that directly. My sense is from his tshuva and from other tshuvas that would be relatively uncontroversial. If someone asked me, can I do that, I would generally say yes. The law, I think, typically does allow it. The law, I think, generally says it's fine, that is considered fair use and does typically grant. Publishers often try to block it because they're afraid if they make it too easy to do that, then it'll allow real piracy. And people actually, I think, often counter-sue the publishers that they're infringing on your rights by preventing you from using your fair rights under, I don't know the exact state of the law, I don't know the exact state of the law in this area, but luckily I don't think that would be a real issue. But talking about a case, let's say, where Reuven has a physical book and Shimon wants a copy, Reuven is willing to copy it for Shimon. I just have to mention one of my favorite and easiest to answer Kosher Mishpat questions I ever got. Someone came over to me and said, he has a shiloh. He said he had purchased some kind of review course for, I don't know if it was the bar or it was the accounting test, actuary. I mean, it was one of these expensive packages cost a fair amount. He used it for his purposes, and now he had the software lying around. A friend of his approached him and said, "You know, I'm taking that test. I would like to copy your software." So the guy said, "You're not really allowed under the law and under the terms of service. I don't think it's the right thing to do." So the friend began to lay a guilt trip on him and say, claim halacha allows it, and you're being frum on my expense, and you should let me do it. And the first guy said he really didn't feel comfortable doing it, but the guy was making an argument. Halacha allows it. I just have my personal scruples. Maybe that's the wrong thing to do. Maybe if it's really allowable, maybe mitzvah chesed and helping other Jews should say I should do it. So he asked me. So tell me, what should I do? So I said, this is a very easy question. I said, if you would want to copy it, and you would ask me are you allowed to copy it, that would be a tough shot. I would have to go through the different shitas. Maybe some say yes, some say no. If you don't want to copy and you feel it's wrong, there definitely are shitas that say you should not be copying it. So you definitely don't have a ridiculous scruple. There definitely are shitas that would support it. There might be shitas the other way, but there definitely are shitas on your side. If that's all you want to know, absolutely, there are shitas that fully support the line you're taking. You can feel stingy. You don't have to feel stingy. You can withhold it in good conscience.
If I own a safer, I can lend it to you, right? And yes. You can read the safer and copy that information into your mind. left, right? So if I own the discs, I can give it to this. I can give him the disc. I'm done with it.
Yeah.
And if it's mine and you're saying I can copy format shift, I can format shift it again.
So let's discuss that both from a legal perspective and from a halakhic perspective.
A different question, which is, I own a Halavaya movie. Not that people would have these things. I know they're not, you know, hopefully we're not allowed to do those anyway. But let's say you had a movie in VCR format. I want to have it on my phone. I could shift it like two or three times once I get onto my phone. But instead, I could just download it from a less than scrupulous source. Not that I would ever do so. I would never do so. But if somebody else wanted to do such a horrible thing, the question is, would halakha feel differently about that? Because I'm not really copying the one that is mine, but it's an identical copy.
So we'll have to see the individual arguments. I personally think that would probably be okay. If you have the right to use that movie, the fact that it's more convenient for you to get a copy from an unlicensed source, I personally think I would have to think about it. I haven't considered it that carefully, but I would personally think that's probably okay. But just for convenience, instead of transcoding it three times, you'd rather just pull the... You know, in some cases, you can argue that if the people who are making that non-legal copy available are doing something wrong, if they actually have a business, for example, and you're supporting them either by actually paying them for it, probably not, or by... Like, if you would actually be paying them for it, for example, then it would be an issue that you're supporting crime. You're essentially, you're kind of accessory after the fact, we would call it, if you're supporting their illegal business model. If it, you know, if you're not supporting them, you're just downloading random pirate copies. So I don't know if the ad revenue that they're trying to make money off counts in this context. If you're not actually supporting them, then I think a good case would be made. That would be much. I have to think about it before giving a final answer. I don't think about it tomorrow, but my inclination would be it's not so bad.
But, I mean, this is really within the realm of understand you're not an expert, but you know more than I do about regular law, American civil law. But my understanding is that it's
and criminal. Don't forget, copyright can be a criminal offense too.
There you go. My understanding is simply usur to download from one of the pirated websites, right, which have this. So the mere, whether you own your own copy or not, by going to these sites and downloading, I think there's some law against that.
So
with Dina DeMarcus.
Yes, the Dina DeMarcus, a number of...
Downloading itself is not illegal. It's keeping it for more than 24 hours is illegal, according to the Millennium Copyright Act. Not
that illegal. Okay, so we have to... At some point, we have to talk to the lawyers. There are actually many countries in Europe, I think, that we're downloading personal use is not usur at all. The people who are making it available are violating copyright law. There are actually countries in the U.S., right, it is 24 hours, whatever, it is illegal. But again, what's illegal, I think, is if you have no right to the... You have to ask a lawyer. Again, I'm not a lawyer. What's illegal, I think, is if you have no right to the content. If you do, that's what Michael's asking. So, again, once we get too deeply into the law, you know, that's... The prudent thing to do is say, ask a lawyer. Regarding Dina Malchusa, Dina Malchusa is a crucial point. I started mentioning earlier there are several different halachic rationales for intellectual property. One of the most powerful is Dina Malchusa Dina. A number of major poskim, Ezra Batsri and others, have basically argued that the primary, most solid, most authoritative reason for a Jew to be required to respect intellectual property are two related principles. One is Dina Malchusa Dina, that we recognize that the law of the land is binding in civil matters. The other is the idea of minhag and of the, again, a similar idea that the commercial custom itself establishes binding halachic norms among Jews. Both those arguments are advanced in many poskim. And returning to the fair use question, insofar as that is our basis for intellectual property, then when you're discussing exceptions, the basic answer is look at the law. A friend of mine in Lakewood, he was once going job hunting for his wife. So his wife was an accountant, I think. So he wanted to do it the old-fashioned way, find a bunch of firms that look like they might have positions in his field, her field, basically knock on doors, make phone calls, and just cold call a bunch of companies to find out if they had positions. So he went to the public library, he found a directory of small businesses in the neighborhood, some kind of reference work in the libraries have, and he wanted to copy about 20 pages, take home, and then get on the phone for a couple hours. So he's about to copy it, and he thought to himself, the front of the book says, no part of this work may be reproduced in a photomechanical optic. Wait a second, can I do this? So he told me he asked one of the leading postmen in Lakewood, who told him, do whatever the law says. If the law would allow this, then do it. If the law doesn't allow it, then don't. Obviously, he couldn't tell him what the law was. So we spent an enjoyable hour or two. The library had a copy of the federal code. I mean, obviously, for a non-lawyer, it's hard to get anything definitive out of that. We did spend an hour or two. That was one of my first introductions to fair use, reading about cases like, it was very funny stuff. There are very stuffy-sounding court cases with titles like, the song When Sonny Sniffs Glue, which is a parody of somebody turning blue and Phil's blues. Is this an infringement on the rights of the plaintiff? And stuff like that. So, anyway, the point is, in that case, we non-lawyers felt that as best as we could ascertain, this would likely be a fair use application. It was a fairly limited form of the work. It was not for. We weren't doing a competing work. It was not such an original work. We thought it probably would be okay. Again, you have to ask a lawyer. But the point is, yes, Din Malchusa is one of the key things that would establish the rules, and then fair use would you'd have to look to a fair use lawyer, an intellectual property lawyer, to clarify for you what fair use is.
It's interesting that the libraries have photocopy machines.
Yeah, so that's actually another part of the story. My friend, when he first approached the librarian, he thought maybe she would know information about what's legal to copy. She looked at him and she said, "Like, that's what we have photocopies for, to copy. He's like, "Yeah, but the book says no par." She just looked at him like she wasn't sure what planet he landed from. My friend was a very airlock, he was a God-fearing man and a person of great integrity. So, anyway. So his first pair of arguments are, as we've said, you can debate them, it might depend on the context, journals, books, magazines, popular magazines, but his first pair of arguments are, A, they have no real expectation that people will follow these injunctions to the letter. B, they themselves don't really mean it. So again, whether they mean it or not is hardly debatable. He's claiming they probably don't mean it. I mean, yes or no? I mean, I don't know. I think some of them probably do mean it. Some of them probably think that every customer who is prohibited from doing it may very well be converted. Maybe not every customer, but if there are a million potential customers out there, and of those, maybe only 5% are law-abiding and care about the law. Out of a million potential customers, that's 50,000 now who are not going to copy it if it says no. And of those 50,000, maybe 5,000 will eventually convert to paying customers. Who knows? So I don't know that the company really doesn't care about personal use. But in any event, so there are post-Kim who explicitly try to distinguish between cases where, who explicitly try to set up a test. You have to ask yourself and answer honestly, is there any chance that you would buy this if you will not download? A very difficult question to answer. There are some things my answer would be definitely yes. I really want to listen to this artist, the song. I definitely would if I can't do it for free. There are some maybe who the answer is almost certainly no. If I happen to be reading a news article and they mention some song and I'm curious what the song is, if I can quickly YouTube it, I'll listen to it. If not, I don't care enough. I'll move on to the next article. A lot of cases are gray and in between. It's really very hard. There might be a musician who I don't really care about now, but if I hear it a few more times, I might appreciate the song better. I might find it catchier. So it's really very hard to answer. And many there's a large gray area. I agree, you can find cases that are black and white, but there's a very, very large gray area where it's really very hard to answer definitively yes or no. I would never buy this. I would buy this. But he doesn't even make that test. He just says they don't really care if you do it for personal use. We should also mention, he keeps talking about personal use, shimush atzmi, and not for commercial purposes. It's not so clear. We only have to define these terms. On the one hand, on the scale of best to worst, the worst case is commercial, where I'm going to rip it off, copy it, and sell knockoffs for a tenth of price. Best case is personal. It's simply for me. I'm a retiree. I don't have a job. I'm not doing this for business. I simply want to increase my understanding of this field. Then there are other cases in between. You're a doctor. You want to learn more. You want to learn more about the latest advances in some medical technique. You're not going to directly compete against the author of the article, but it's relevant to your profession. If you didn't have access, you might want to buy it. It's a business expense. You could probably write it off as some kind of cost of doing business. Is that called personal use or is that called commercial use? I mean, it's for, I don't know how the law would define it, but certainly the Rabbi Abraham and the Rabbi Waldenberg keep on talking about personal use as opposed to commercial use. So what exactly use in the context of your profession or career. I'm not sure whether they would... presumably, if Rabbi Abraham, who was a doctor, was asking about copying journal articles, he may have read some of them just for entertainment, but there were probably a lot he was reading for his work, for his medical work, for his medical halachic work. So I don't even know whether we would call that personal use or not. All right. So that's the beginning of Rav Waldenberg's analysis. He goes on. We'll skip some of the intervening material. And he goes on to another argument. Toward the top of the second side of the page, paragraph beginning, Shanis, he says, he makes an argument for Midas Tov. Even if we were to know that the rights holder does absolutely care, even for personal use, without any question of will it hurt his sales, won't it hurt, he doesn't care. It's mine, we paid for it, we did it, we spent money to do this. I don't want anybody freeloading off my work. I don't think it's fair. I don't appreciate it. So Rav Waldenberg says halacha would strike that down. Halacha would invalidate such an objection on the grounds that it is Midas Tov. The halacha has a famous doctrine called kofen al midas tov, that we compel people not to behave in ways, this week's Parsha Vayera, we compel people not to behave in ways that are like the evil city of Sodom. And this is a halachic rule in general, that if someone has no earthly reason, no rational reason for raising some objection, even though he technically should have the right to raise that objection in halacha, or if he has no rational, self-interested reason for doing that, just so somebody else shouldn't benefit from it, halacha sometimes strikes that down as midas tov. The truth is, he himself acknowledges the scope of this rule is far from clear. The primary application of this rule is ex post facto. If somebody used someone else's property, and then the person whose property was used sends him a bill and asks to pay for it, so if we can show that there was no harm done, even if you benefited quite a lot, if we can show that the plaintiff didn't suffer, we'll say midas tov, we won't allow billing for it. However, the question of lechatchila, do I have the right to demand that you let me use your property because you have no real reason to object, that is far from clear. It's a tremendous machlokes poskim. And even down to contemporary poskim, or near contemporary poskim, it is far from clear whether I have the right to demand that you allow me to use your property just because you have no reason to object. There was an interview given by Professor Nachum Rockover. Nachum Rockover is a leading expert on Mishmar Ivri, on halacha from a modern civil law perspective. He gave an interview to Ami magazine, and the reviewer asked him, which is a very funny pairing to begin with. Ami is a kind of from Haredi magazine. Rockover is a professor. He's a Talmud Chacham, but he's a leading kind of academic, quasi-academic expert. I'm a tremendous admirer of his, but he's a tremendous Talmud Chacham expert on Choshen Mishpat. So at one point in the interview, the reviewer asked him, how would you explain what is unique about halacha as opposed to other systems of law? That's what Mishpat Ivri guys do all the time. They kind of compare and contrast halacha to other systems. They try to recast and rephrase halacha using modern legal terminology. They compare halakhic doctrines to legal ones. And they asked Rockover, how would you explain what is different, what is special about halakha as opposed to other systems of law? So Rockover said, basically, the idea of a Femishur Sadin and Midas Tov. He says, everyone, all societies recognize the notion of ethics. There's law and there's ethics, legal ethics, business ethics, medical ethics. But ethics is something which, by its very definition, is not something that the courts do. Ethics is you have a professional obligation, your professional body might enforce it. It's not a legal obligation. Halacha, he says, incorporates ethics into the halacha itself. Shulchan Aruch itself, which is the code of Jewish law, contains many things which are essentially ethical, but halacha subsumes them and incorporates them into the halachic framework. And one of the examples is Midas Tov. He says, Rockover says, there was a dintara he knew about where somebody ordered an appliance, a piano maybe, a washing machine, and the purchaser, when they were delivering it, they couldn't get it into his house. The doors, the hallways were too narrow, didn't fit inside the door. They were searching for a solution for how to get it inside, so they realized that a neighbor, and the purchaser and his neighbor, I think both had balconies that were adjacent, and the neighbor's hallways were bigger, so the suggestion was, I think, to bring it up through the neighbor's house, through the balconies, and get it into the house that way. They needed the neighbor's permission. The neighbor didn't want to grant permission. He didn't have any real objection, apparently, but he wasn't interested in helping his neighbor. So the question came to Basin. Could Basin force the neighbor to agree? Now, you can think of a lot of reasons why you might not like it. The workers are going to smash furniture on the way in. They're going to get their muddy shoes all over the floor. They're going to bother me. I want some privacy. I'm going to have to have workers tramping through my apartment for an hour. Lots of good reasons why he might object. I don't know. Those were not the issues. Those were not issues. The neighbor was not raising these objections. The neighbor simply said, I don't let my property, a man's home, is his castle. I'm not sure if he just wanted to extort money, he wanted to get paid for it, or he just wanted to be unneighborly. I don't know what his frame of mind was. The neighbor said, nope, my property, you have no right to demand that you can use, to use my property. Came to Basin. Basin said, nope, kofen on me desto, you have no reason to object. Again, assuming there was no reason to object, you have to let him. Rockover said, that's halacha. I told this to a lawyer friend of mine, an American lawyer, I think he said, who laughed at me. He said, this is crazy. You know, what court would do such a thing? He said, I have no idea what the law is, but Rockover says, it's not what secular law would say. Halacha says, yes, kofen al midas dom, you have to allow it. As I said, it's far from clear. Rockover doesn't get into all the details. It is far from clear whether halacha would actually force you to do that. There are posts who take the Western notion that it's not nice if you say no, and maybe we'll call you names and meet us down, but at the end of the day, halacha cannot compel someone who has property to relinquish control to allow use of it to somebody else. But Rav Waldenberg, in this tshuva, he goes through some of this literature, but he concludes that kofen midas dom would apply here. He concludes that we would force, and then he makes the point that you made before. He says the whole issue of kofen midas dom is when it's my property, you want me to allow you to use it. I can say, no, it's mine, you can't use it. Here he says, Reuven bought the book. The book does not belong to the publisher anymore. Shimon wants to copy it. So the physical book belongs to Reuven. The publisher objects because he has some kind of abstract right to the book. Here he's on the contrary. The physical book belongs to the customers. They want to copy it. It's midas dom for the publisher to object. He wants to conclude that, therefore, there is no right because of midas dom for the publisher to object. Again, this whole thing obviously rests upon the assumption that the publisher has no rational motivation for objecting. In the real world, I think they very often do, because you never know who will be converted to a customer. Even if you won't go ahead and buy it tomorrow, maybe your university will, maybe your practice will, maybe you will change your mind. So at the end of the day, if we assume his assumption that there is no reason whatsoever for the publisher to object, then arguably you can make this argument. But in the real world, in many cases, maybe even most cases, it's far from clear that the publisher has no reason to object. That's pretty much Rav Waldenberg's treatment, both because of the arguments of Yeush, everyone does it, they don't really mean to object, they're not allowed to object, because of all these reasons, Rav Waldenberg says, just in general, you can copy Torah articles and journal articles. Again, he doesn't discuss exactly what context, journals, popular magazines, an entire sefer, one article, doesn't define exactly what he means by personal use, commercial use. The tshuva leaves a lot of questions, it leaves a lot of things open, but in general, Rav Waldenberg's position is that he is inclined toward leniency to allowing this copy. There are others who are more strict. One other lenient view was the Shevet Halevi, Rav Osner, another leading Haredi posik in Israel. He was asked about a very common case, I've been asked this several times, about a teacher who wishes to, instead of, let's say, buying an entire work for her class, wants to make a copy, a few pages, and distribute copies. Rav Osner allows it. But it's very unclear why. He says, you're not copying the whole book, and it's for a good cause, it's for education, and it would be very difficult to force kids to buy complete copies of all works they're going to be taught from, and therefore it's okay. The problem is, you know, those are arguments from pragmatism and expedience. It's not clear what happened to any rights the publisher has, the authors have, in their works. So again, from a legal perspective, such things may very well be fair use, depending on how much of the book is being copied. I'm not a lawyer, but when I have spoken to teachers, I've occasionally said that what they wanted to do sounds to me like it would probably fall under fair use if it's small enough, etc. But Rav Osner just says it's mutter without really explaining why. And other posts can push back very strongly against this. For example, the Be'er Sarim, Rav Schlesinger, he brings, I didn't quote the Shevet Halevi for space reasons, but the Shevet Halevi says it's okay. He says, the Shevet Halevi says, oh, it's not a whole book, it's only a few pages. I don't understand. He says, what? He says, who cares what the reason is? Who cares how much is? Once you accept the fundamental notion that halacha grants a right holder, halacha recognizes the right of a right holder, who cares what his purpose is? Who cares how much he's copying? What does it matter? Rights are rights. I can't steal one cookie from you, even though you have lots more cookies and you won't even miss this cookie. It's not my cookie. So again, the argument could be made that if the primary framework for analyzing intellectual property halacha is dinin malchusa, or the prevailing minhag. You can argue if the minhag would allow it, if the law would allow it, then it's mutter. But that's not the argument Rav Hosman makes, but that could be an argument. Other poskim might make that argument too. Rav Blay, Rav Yaakov Yeshaya Blay, another leading Kashrut Mishpat expert, contemporary expert, passed away a few years ago. He goes back and forth on these questions. He initially approaches the halachic rights, intellectual property, as an unfair competition issue. So he says, as long as it's for personal use, maybe that wouldn't apply. He actually does address the question of, but maybe that means they'll sell fewer copies, and he tries to explain why he doesn't think that's a problem. Not sure I fully understand why. He goes on. He says that he does object to Rav Osner, the case of copying for the class. That case, he actually is inclined towards stringency. He says, that's commercial, he says. It's not commercial in the sense of selling for a profit. I have a job. The school has a job. The school has expenses, and the school takes in money in the form of tuition and fees, and it spends money in the terms of teaching and others. That's a business, whether it's for profit or non-profit. He doesn't get into all these details. He just says, what's the difference, he says, from doing it for money or I'm doing it as part of an economic enterprise of another sort? He says that's not private. That's copying on a commercial scale, he says. He doesn't understand that. So on the one hand, he's inclined to be lenient, sort of like Rav Waldenberg, when it's really personal use, like you just want to copy an article for your own use, but copying in a school setting, he's not sure that's personal use. And then he goes on, in the last paragraph, he says, if you want to copy Tochnot Mechashev, you want to copy software programs, that he says he's more stringent on, and he gives an argument which again is not it's not completely true, but he says Shekein Kol Tochna, every program is Miyuedet Yoser L'Shimush Mischari. Software is more of a generally for commercial use as opposed to cassettes or tapes, which are for personal use. He was obviously writing in a case where business software was still the early 80s or something, where a lot of real software was commercial. Today, so much of software, the whole app thing on phones, even on PCs, games are huge, and a lot of personal productivity apps, even Office, Microsoft Office, a lot of them are bought by businesses, a lot of them are bought, some are bought by individuals. So at the end of the day, obviously he's not, I don't think he claims to be an expert in the whole history of software development. He was writing at a time where software was typically a commercial proposition and was meant to be used in a commercial context, so he's more stringent. Again, things which are for personal use, he's more inclined to be lenient. Again, he's approaching this from a perspective of the primary issue of competition of infringement is competition. Doesn't apply when it's personal use. But again, if you accept that there's a fundamental native right to property, then like what Schlesinger says in the Bear Star, maybe everything should be usher unless you have a legal exemption of fair use.